Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, Mommy Dearest, who's your mommy? The political mommy wars are starting to heat up. Who's right, who's wrong? And where's June Cleaver where you need her? It's finally head-to-head, Obama versus Romney for the gold cup that is the White House. What impact does Rick Santorum have on the GOP race now? Did the GOP give Barack Obama's camp the blueprint to retake 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue? The Senate kills the Buffett rule. Does this mean his secretary won't be sitting in the gallery for the next State of the Union? The Secret Service and GSA, two scandals are just feeding the media. This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics. And good afternoon, listeners. It's Tuesday, and we're back live here on Blog Talk Radio. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's back room, and a moderator that's somewhere in the Midwest. Actually, I'm in Oklahoma doing what I do best, and that's arguable. And as we do every Tuesday, we get around the round table, and we bring together America's premier cigar-smoking and martini-drinking roundtable of pundits. Joining me, as they do every Tuesday, or almost every Tuesday, to my left, if I was there, he would be the former eight-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He would be Congressman Al Swift. Al, how you doing?
Hi, Howard. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, doing fine. To my 11 o'clock, if I was there and he was there, would be the former Undersecretary of Commerce, longtime Senate staffer, and a very distinguished and dapper fellow at the Stinson Center. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Alan, how you doing?
Just been a pleasure.
Good to hear you. To my 12 o'clock, as he does every Tuesday, whether I'm there or not, he's the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford and the former Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, hi.
Hi, Justin. I'm happy to be here. It's a lovely day in Washington.
I know. I wish I was there. We'll talk about why I wish I was there in a second. But to his left, if I was there, and he was there also, would be the former chairman of the Maryland Democratic Party, longtime Washington insider, Carl Garvin. Carl, how you doing, sir?
I'm okay. How are you?
Doing fine. And to my right, as he would be if he was there and I was there, he would be the vice president of Eurasia or China Affairs for the Eurasia Center. He is a bar certified attorney in the state of New York and the great District of Columbia. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, how you doing?
Doing great. Glad to be with everyone on this great day in D.C.
Well, this is, again, the now famous Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio, live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. I want to put like a stamp on the radio show that says, as seen in Roll Call. We had a great write-up in Roll Call this week, guys.
Well, we had a great Roll Call, great article in the Washington Post, too.
We're getting some good publicity. Alan Moore, did you happen to see the write-up, and what'd you think?
No, I saw it. I thought, hey, it's about time, these guys. They claim to be on top of the news. They're a little slow on this, but better late than never.
Well, you know, we are broadcasting from our beloved cigar bar, but there's bigger news in the district. Let's get to it. I mean, we skip one day, and then Rick Santorum drops out. Coincidence? I think not. I think if we had been live, he'd still be in the race today, but that's another factor. Basically, for those of you who missed us last week, and we missed last week, GOP hopeful Rick Santorum, former senator of Pennsylvania, has quote-unquote suspended his campaign for the presidency for the GOP nomination. Kind of big news last week, and this means now that it is head-to-head. It is Obama v. Romney. First, let's look at the Santorum factor. Bob, why do you think he dropped out now? What was happening that maybe had spurned him? Now, there is one fact that we want to talk about, you know, the issue with his youngest daughter, Bella. And, of course, we always hope the best for Bella. I know she's out of the hospital, but I know she's still got a good fight ahead of her. We're hoping for the best. But what politically was going through his mind to make him pull out at this stage?
Well, number one, I think it was money. And number two, he's never going to be more popular now or powerful now than he is at the moment. If he would have gone into the next week's primaries, he was going to lose New York, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and he might have lost his home state of Pennsylvania, which would have really, you know, put the nail in him. I think he did a smart thing by pulling out now and basically not having been, you know, run over by a steamroller on the 24th, losing every state possibly and losing every state but Pennsylvania for sure. So I think he's never going to be in a better position to have some influence probably at the convention and maybe in the long term. I think he was smart to get out when he did.
Alan Moore, do you think that he maybe has seen the writing on the wall that Pennsylvania was, in fact, quickly becoming out of reach for him?
Well, I don't know about out of reach, but back 2 weeks ago when we met, we talked about this the possibility of this very scenario, that he was about to be crushed on the primaries that day, and Romney won 90% of the electoral votes that were up that day, and then along came these states next week, as Bob points out, and he only had a chance in Pennsylvania. He was showing weaker and weaker in Pennsylvania. He was having to spend money that he didn't have, and the money was clearly a big issue for him because there's nobody standing behind him who says, never mind, keep going, we'll back you up later. And I think he realized the numbers can't work. And even if he were to win in Pennsylvania, what would he lose? What would he win? He wouldn't win any significant momentum. He still would have been crushed that day in the delegate vote. So it was not that big a surprise. I mean, we've learned that whenever these guys say I'm in it till the end, that's when you start thinking, gee, is he about to drop out? With one exception, of course.
That would be
one exception.
That
would be Newt Gingrich. Now, weeks ago, I said he was a dead man walking. Then I said he was a dead man walking with a walker. Well, today he said to a small group in Texas that he's still in this. People want him to stay in. Why get out? He's like the tortoise. Okay, he is now a dead man crawling like a tortoise on the floor.
Very, very subtle, Alan, as always. Very subtle, as always. Congressman Al, I'm going to go to you on this next question. You know, when we look at the circumstances surrounding the anti-Mitt Romney vote, it seems that there still was some slight momentum in Santorum's favor. We still hadn't gone through Texas. We still hadn't gone through a majority of the southwestern part of the Bible Belt. What, in your opinion, Al, do you think it was smart from a standpoint of getting out now instead of maybe trying to get Texas and holding Texas till Tampa?
For all of the reasons just said, I think it was smart to get out. But I would include your opening remarks. I think that the press gets too cynical sometimes. I think the factors that Bob and Alan talked about were real, and I'm sure they had to play some part of it. But the fact that he had a very, very sick daughter is, and mind you, I don't agree with Rick Santorum on anything. I couldn't agree with him on the sun coming up in the morning. But I think he was sincere about that. I think he was really very, very worried about his daughter. And I think that probably was a major factor as well.
Bob, I mean, you know, Al brings up a good point. I mean, we've seen a lot of candidates talk about, I'm not running for re-election. I want to spend more time with my family. You know, usually when we hear that in Washington, D.C., that's a code word for I'm about to get fired or I'm about to drop out. In this case, though, it seems that this is taking a toll both mentally, emotionally, and physically on his family. You've been involved with many campaigns. How tough is it on the family, Bob?
Well, you know, a campaign is always tough on the family because the family, you know, is a whole, and they have to listen to their parent, male or female, be beat over the head, yelled at, you know, made fun of, get bad poll numbers from. You know, it's always tough. And I agree with Al completely. I think it is. I think it part of the reason that he pulled out when he did is, or he was a he had to pull out pretty soon, was his daughter. She has a very serious illness. It's one that I think his daughter is, I believe, 3 years old, and my understanding is that this chromosome type disease is one that very few people, children who get this disease, survive to their 12th or 13th birthday. I mean, it's a very, very serious thing, and she's been in the hospital twice since the first of the year. So as any parent, I think could sympathize a great deal with, you know, what he's been going through. You know, emotionally with his daughter, and at the same time trying to run a campaign. I mean, that's got to be an awfully tough stress.
Alan Moore, you had a comment.
Yeah, this is a very delicate, sensitive subject. The subject of Santorum's daughter. My understanding of her congenital illness is that usually kids don't even live past the first year. So to live till she's three is pretty unusual, and she needs around-the-clock care. Now, he early on in his campaign made a big point of saying, I'm in this campaign because of my daughter. And he said that he made accusations that I could never quite figure out how it worked, that he wanted to fight Obamacare, if you will, because people like his daughter might never be able to live. Well, I never might not be born in the first place, and I thought, what's the basis for that? Where is that coming from? And I never could get it. Then I used to wonder whenever I would see him and his wife and a lot of his kids, most of whom are teenagers or in their 20s, and I would wonder where the little girl was. So I've worked with Santorum, and you guys have heard me speak admiringly of him in some of the work that he's done, and you've also seen me be very distressed at some of the things he said that I thought disqualified him for to be president. And on this one, I'm really torn to know just what to think, because on the one hand, he said he was running for her. She's very ill. Even when she's well, she's not that well. She's never going to be cured of this congenital disease. She has been in and out of the hospital. So I'm not sure how to process the information that is family. I'll say this about it. He did not say that was the lead factor. He said that's an issue. He said also, we have no money. We're out of money, and I began to look at that and realize that I personally was not prepared to take on that debt. So, I mean, I guess I'm trying to sort out how it felt to me a little bit like he was trying to have it both ways. He was in the campaign because of his daughter. Now he's dropping out of the campaign because of his daughter, and the daughter has had this illness throughout the period.
Well, let me ask, Congressman Al, let me go to you. I mean, from a Democratic viewpoint, using Alan's mentality on this, you know, on one hand he's running for his daughter, on the other hand he's running, you know, he's dropping out of the race, you know, for his daughter. Did Rick Santorum politicize his daughter, Congressman Al? Congressman Al, we can't hear you. Bob, I'm going to put that question to you. Did he in fact flip?
We can't hear Al.
You've got to let him in, I think, Justin.
Okay. Let me go to Bob. Bob, why don't you take that question?
What's the question? I didn't hear it all.
Did Rick Santorum politicize his daughter?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think he politicized his daughter. I mean, it was the situation itself raised the issue of his daughter, the effect of her health. But I don't think that Santorum used his daughter in any way was inappropriate. I don't think that at all.
Am I getting through it all?
Yeah, you are now, Congressman Al.
You are now,
okay.
My reaction is that his use of his daughter initially was fairly cynical, and that his use of his daughter at the end was genuine.
Interesting take. Let's get off that for a second and talk about the effect that Rick Santorum is going to have down the road. Carl, let me go to you. Do you think that Rick Santorum, in fact, could back Romney wholeheartedly, especially after the bashing he gave him in some of the Southern Belt states?
There's a reason that he wouldn't. He wants to be now a team player. He's gotten himself into a position where he could be a leader in the Republican Party now and at some future date. He might even be looking for a position in the administration. So all of that points to the fact that he could get into this and get into it pretty handily. Just remember, back in 1960, Lyndon Johnson came into the campaign at a late date, made a lot of remarks that raised the ire of the Kennedy Democrats, and ended up being vice president. Hillary and President Obama had their words during the campaign, mostly from Hillary's side and the former president. And they turned around, and Hillary turned around and campaigned hard for President Obama.
Well,
so,
Bob, we've heard about we've heard some buzz, but not a lot, that there may have been some April surprise or some sort of April backdoor deal with Santorum and the Romney camp in the discussion. Do you think there's any validity to that, or is that just political rumor anytime somebody backs out?
I just think that's a rumor. I would not see that at all.
Okay.
That would not, to me, I can't see that at all. What is interesting, I noticed yesterday that there was an announcement that I believe the woman's name is Beth Meyer, I believe.
Yes.
She has been one of his personal assistants for a number of years, and she has been tasked with the responsibility of beginning the vetting problem, the vetting process, I should say, of potential vice presidential candidates. So that is now front and center and within the campaign apparatus to, in effect, start looking at the potential candidates and their backgrounds and their foibles and their good points.
Well, Alan,
and the three top candidates have both said they don't want it, which is
well, of course, everybody says they don't want it.
And I think at the very least, Santorum could be an effective surrogate for Romney to help him bridge the gap with the conservative wing of the party. I think that's going to be Santorum's major role in the next few months.
Alan Moore, let me go to you on that, voicing what Ralph was saying, is looking down the road, what exactly is the role? Will he be an effective surrogate? Will he be able to coalesce that Tea Party-esque buckle of the Bible Belt vote and bring him towards somebody like Mitt Romney, or is that too far gone?
I don't know. I'm skeptical about it. He always fights with the other Santorum, and the other Santorum, the old Santorum that had largely been kept under wraps in all the early part of the campaign, started to emerge, and he got uglier and nastier as it went, and it prompted a lot of people who know him to say, A, that's why I never endorsed him, and B, I was just waiting for it to come out. So, it's amazing how fast people disappear when they drop out. I mean, look at the Canes and the Perrys and the Bachmans. I mean, they're not gone totally from the face of the earth. They just disappeared. Santorum has been largely invisible, and let's face it, he's got some challenges at home. I don't, and in his speech where he stepped aside, he did not mention Romney. He didn't say, Romney's now my guy, or I think he'll make a great president. He didn't mention it, and he's been avoiding any comment. None of those things, but most of all, the really ugly stuff he said during the campaign about Romney endear him. I take Carl's point that historically success sort of trumps everything, and if you think that something can help you, I'm one of the few guys 4 years ago who said I could see one condition under which Obama would pick Hillary to go on the ticket with him, and that condition would be if he was convinced that that was his only chance of winning. Now, and I think that's where we are with Romney, but I would be flabbergasted if Santorum were seriously considered. And beyond that, I don't see him. He can go out and around, but he's got to earn a living. I don't see him being an all-that-powerful and influential surrogate, especially in light of all of the ugly stuff that he said about Romney in the course of the campaign.
Well, I want to go to Congressman Al. Yeah. Does, in fact, he just disappear and go into the sunset and go on the talking head circuit? Or do you think, from a Democratic standpoint, he may go and stump for Romney?
I think he'll stump for Romney. I think he wants to have some heft within Republican circles, and you can't have that if you don't support the party nominee. So I think he'll do the right thing.
Bob, is this something that he's got to do it to stay relevant?
Well, he's certainly going to stay a lot more relevant if he is stumping for the a candidate. So, and I think he will. I mean, it's history usually shows you that the candidate who doesn't get the nomination, who is the last one standing short of getting the nomination, usually does some work for the candidate. Some of it is some more than others, but they have usually been a part of the team to the extent of saying good things and going where their strength is and urging support for the nominee. I expect that to happen here.
And their excuse for quote flip-flopping is that their candidate is better than that other guy in any event. So
sure, you know, right now I've seen there's a report today in the Washington Post that talks about it's a survey of Republican conservative voters, and the report says basically they are moving to Romney. Now, obviously, they were Santorum or Gingrich people before, but look, the thing that's going to unite the Republican Party, as nothing else will do it, no matter who the nominee is anybody but Obama. Because I think an awful lot of the Republicans firmly believe that the government is very much on the wrong track with the health care program, with other things. And from their standpoint, you know, any Republican is a better person to be the president than this particular gentleman, Mr. Obama. So I expect that, you know, it's going to be it's not going to be very hard to unite the party.
Well, we're going to let that be the last word. We're coming up on a break right now. But when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the Republican politics. It now looks like it is going to be Obama v. Romney. We're going to talk about that race, and this also calls into question the mommy wars. When we come back, this is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., by way of Oklahoma, Maryland, and Virginia. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
I have felt from the very
Thank you.
Room 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., by way of Claremore, Oklahoma, Virginia, and Maryland. And we're going to continue the discussion right now on GOP politics and the GOP presidential race, but actually, it's no longer a GOP race. It's now a head-to-head, full-on general election run between Mitt Romney, the presumptive GOP, short of something major happening, GOP candidate, and the incumbent, President Barack Obama. And I got to tell you something. I don't even think the ink on the press of Rick Santorum's statement was even dry before they started going head-to-head, Romney and Obama. I want to start with you, Bob Hines. Is this a sign of things to come? Is this going to be a bloodfest?
Would you repeat the question? It's a bit of background noise up here.
Okay. The question is this going to be a bloodfest? They literally just took off the gloves. I mean, Rick Santorum wasn't even done speaking before Obama and Romney started going after each other. Is this a sign of things to come?
Oh, well, okay. Well, they're going to hit people. They're going to hit each other as hard as they can. As many things as they can possibly come up with, they're going to do. The reality is, it's going to be a real slugfest. All you have to do is look at the inability of the two parties on Capitol Hill to be even a little bit more than civil to each other. They can't get anything done. I cannot conceive of either party doing anything but of coming up with every possible campaign trick, campaign idea, campaign effort, call it what you will, that will, they think, help them win the election in November. And I think it's going to be, like most campaigns are, there's going to be some pretty tough stuff said. And it's going to start, I would expect, pretty soon.
Congressman Al, is this going to be a sign of things to come with the Democratic Party? I mean, They are really ready for bear.
Yes, they are, and the president has already started. Now, I would caution both parties. There's already been some evidence that the public doesn't take well to really nasty campaigning. We've been through 4 or 5 years of bickering on Capitol Hill. And I think that a lot of people are just sick and tired of that approach. So I think those who write the attack ads are going to need to be very skillful in doing so. And here is where if I were either Romney or Obama, I'd be scared. It's those independent expenditure people that you have more control over than you claim, but you don't have intimate control over them. And they're the ones that are likely to go out and throw bombs that will rebound.
But, Alan Moore, I mean, are we really in a situation where we could see politically mutually assured destruction?
No. It always feels like that, and we're never quite there. I take a little issue with Bob, who says that nothing will happen on the Hill. There's some things they have to do. They have to do spending bills. They'll do them. That's not easy stuff. We've got this big mandated spending cut. coming up. We've talked before, Bob has done it, about all the things that are waiting for us at the end of this year, the so-called Bush-era tax cuts, which expire, the big deficit deals that have to be put together. I'm not saying we'll fix them before then, but you just never know. In the meantime, we do have to make decisions on spending for next year and a variety of other things. So it's going to be awkward and difficult. But remember, in the case of the Senate, for the everybody in the Senate and everybody in the House, although it sometimes feels like they're only there for purposes of elections and to get reelected, that's not how they feel about it. Just ask Al Swift if that's all he ever thought about was, oh, my gosh, I can't do any work now because we've got an election coming up later this year. Senators are elected for 6 years. They can be frustrated, but they can also be frustrated at the perception that they're not getting anything done. There are people working behind the scenes. It's a tough slog. It's a very hot, politicized environment. But I don't think any of us know just exactly how this thing is going to play out. We do know it's going to be expensive. We know there's going to be a lot of voices, loud voices. We know it's going to get ugly. And then we'll have an election, and then we'll go on from there.
Yeah, but Carl, I mean, this is a far cry from your days as chairman of the Democratic Party there in Maryland. I mean, you're seeing a whole new level of use of social media, the concept of the super PAC. Does this get worse before it gets better, in your opinion, Carl?
It very well could. I hope it doesn't get out of control, but it could get worse before it gets better. We'll just have to wait and see. The vice president and the president have been poking at the Romney for weeks now, and Romney is trying to give it right back in his own little way. Whether that's going to be successful or not, we'll only know 7 months from now. But it could be a very long and hot 7 months.
Well,
Carl, of all of us, you are the meanest in his own little way. I love that.
Hey, Ralph, let me go to you. Ralph, I mean, you know, when we look at Romney and we look at Obama, where's the international feeling for this? I mean, is there a certain hope internationally that Obama stays in place, that if we get a Romney in place, it could be dangerous for our international presence?
I think the international community, especially if you talk to the Europeans, they feel more comfortable with Obama and his policies. He's very much like them in his approach and his style of leadership. At the same time, they do respect Romney for his business acumen, but they are not really comfortable with anyone in the current Republican field. But Romney has very good, very strong business skills and understands the international economic system. So they can't totally dismiss Romney like they've done the other Republican candidates who they have felt don't have any credibility on the international scene. But what it comes down to is there's strong support for Obama among almost everyone in the international community.
Alan Moore, when we look at talking about surrogates before, and I want this to be the last question before we get into the major issue that came up today in the head-to-head. When we look at who could be stumping, the one stumper that we think is going to come out early and possibly come out strong, which is surprising a lot of people, is Bill Clinton. There's obviously no love lost there between the Obama and the Clinton camp, but Alan Moore, is Bill Clinton becoming overexposed, or does he still have the same allure as he did, let's say, 4 years ago?
Well, it seems like you got two questions that you're putting together there. One, does he have credibility, or is he overexposed? The place where he has credibility is sort of as a statesman, as an international humanitarian, supporting new ideas. He's got the Clinton Global Initiative. He's got the Clinton Foundation that does a lot of work in global AIDS and global health and some really terrific work. Now, I don't think in the to the extent he's doing things like that, that he's overexposed because he's careful about it. On the political front, on the other hand, I would be flabbergasted to see him highly engaged and active on the campaign trail. I think he would get old very fast, and it's just not what ex-presidents do. That doesn't mean he won't speak out in interviews, pull out his little ice pick and stick it up Romney's ribs without anybody looking whenever he can do it, and he's very good at that. But I don't see him out there doing surrogate-type work and lots of speeches. It would be highly unusual to see that.
Yeah, but
I'm sorry, go ahead, Justin.
No, I was going to just ask you, from a Democratic standpoint, what's your thoughts on that, Al?
I think one of the big things is Clinton is so good that everyone's got to be careful that he doesn't overshadow the president. So I think that argues for what Alan suggested would be, yes, a role. He'll pop up here and there, and once in a while, maybe very importantly so. But he can't campaign full-time, or he'll outshine Obama, who's no mean speaker himself, but there just isn't anyone around these days that's as good as Bill Clinton.
Well, Bob, let me go to you, Bob, real quick on this one. From the Republican standpoint, who could they dust off a George W. Bush 43 and have him stump for Romney?
I don't think that 43 is going to be doing a whole lot. He has assiduously avoided, being involved in politics over the last few years, and I don't think he's going to fundamentally change that. I don't think that I don't think McCain will be particularly active either. I think Romney's going to be the lead dog, and as you would expect, and I think he's going to be pretty much it's going to be he and his vice presidential nominee.
Alan Moore, do you agree with that? Do you think that they'll keep 43 at home?
Well, it's not they're going to keep 43 at home. 43 is staying home. Nobody controls him. He does not have the need for the limelight that Bill Clinton does. He's made it very clear that he thinks it's completely inappropriate for any ex-president to trash an existing president. He's said that publicly. He has been very careful picking issues that he wanted to get involved in, and he's only reluctantly saying much of anything about the campaign and the candidates. So, yeah, they may invite him to give a speech at the convention. It would be a little odd if they don't, but Romney's people probably don't want him all that much as a surrogate. But even if they did, he won't do it.
What about somebody like a McCain? If we have McCain come out, Congressman Al, do you bring out McCain to stump for Romney?
Oh, I think Romney could use McCain, sure. Absolutely.
The question is, will he?
You have to look inside Romney's mind. I would think it would be a mistake to not use McCain like a rifle shot in places where he will be really effective, talking about defense, talking about issues of that sort that have been, McCain's bailiwick. I think he could be an effective help to Romney.
Hey, Alan, you brought this up last time, but we're going to bring it up now. The gloves coming off in the head-to-head Romney v. Obama, or Obama v. Romney, depending on how you look at it. The first big shot across the bow seems to be Mommygate. You'll have to remind me, unfortunately, I have my notes with me right now, a Democratic pundit who basically said that Ann Romney was out of touch because she was a stay-at-home mom.
The actual words? The woman is named Hillary Rosen.
Thank you.
She's been around Democratic politics a long time. For some years, she ran the Recording Industry Association of America, which is one of the bigger, fancier blue chip lobbying jobs around D.C. because it brings in a salary of about $1 million or more, and you get to hang out with all the big recording artists. So it's a real plum. She left that a few years ago in order to ostensibly spend more time with. She has a wife, and they had adopted two children, and two very small children, wanted to spend more time with it and not be working as hard. She's also a CNN pundit, and she used the highly unfortunate choice of words where she said of Ann Romney, how can he listen to her for advice? She has never worked a day in her life. And that's the quote, and that was the cause of the major explosion, which for a little while she tried to push back on. Finally, she shut up, humbled herself, and declined to go on any of the Sunday talk shows. But it was manna from heaven for the Republicans, where the White House, the Obama folks have just, and many people in Congress have just been beating holy hell out of Republicans, particularly the candidates, including Romney, for their failure to be supportive of women, their lack of understanding of women, and their policies, which would be very harmful to women, saying that Republicans have declared a war on women. And because the Republicans were speaking with so many different voices, they couldn't figure out how best to counter this, what I consider to be an absolutely ridiculous and absurd notion, but nonetheless it was sticking. And so along comes Hillary Rosen throwing a little lifeline, certainly not intending to, but by diverting attention with, you know, another sideshow. It's a reminder of how vulnerable the basic storyline is to some remark by somebody that most people have never heard of.
Alan, let's be honest. And we've got a caller on the line. I think it's a caller. Caller, you're on the air with Backroom Politics.
Just listening, guys.
Okay, not a problem. We'll put you back on hold. Alan, you know, when we heard about Hillary Rosen's, Ms. Rosen's comments the other day about Ann Romney and she's never worked a day in her life, the aftermath of what happened after her little flub actually kind of created a bizarro world. Bob, it looked like that all of a sudden the Republicans were pro-women and pro-women's rights and defending the rights of the mother and the mom at home, and the Democrats were the anti-woman campaign. How did we get to such a bizarro world on this?
Well, let me put it this way. The whole thing started out about a month ago when the president had decided they were going to require the Catholic institutions to provide birth control pills, you know, medications to their workers. Of course, you know, that was the start of about 2 months now of struggling over who's friendly to women and who isn't, what's going on. And I find the whole thing rather, really ridiculous how people have gotten themselves all wrapped up in this situation. Seems to me that Hillary Rosen is the latest piece of it, and I hope it's the last piece of it. I do think that the truth is that the Republicans have more trouble with the woman vote than the Republicans do by a long shot, and I think it's because most women feel more comfortable with the positions of most of the Democratic organization, the reality, than they do the Republicans. And yeah, I think it's a problem for Republicans, a very serious problem.
But Congressman Al, looking at this over the span of the week now, when we hear about the Mommygate situation, does Ann Romney help the Republicans in their race to try and get the women back, particularly the soccer moms?
Oh, I think she does. But what my problem is that the whole foo-farah is made up out of nothing. What's her name? The Democrat's name?
Hillary Rosen.
Hillary Rosen.
She clearly used inartful language. What she meant to say was that Ann Romney doesn't have any experience in managing and running the economic engines of the society, and therefore it's absurd to think she is giving advice on that topic to Romney. That isn't what she said. And the Republicans jumped on it, and to jump on something when your opponent has a slip of the tongue is old, I'm sure, as George Washington. But at some point, this becomes ridiculous because it's all about nothing. What Rosen said was accurate. How she said it was foolish and opened up the Democrats to a counterattack, which I think is reasonably effective.
Hold on. Let's go to Carl. Go ahead.
Well, I think we have a decidedly advantage in this area. It isn't us who go to state legislatures and try to introduce legislation that is against women and what they do with their bodies. We don't, in the Congress, there's been legislation introduced in the same way. Hillary Rosen is a very, very nice person, and she misspoke. If I were part of her group, I would say to her, Hillary, where did that come from? But, people do, and everybody jumped on it, and I think in about a week and a half, 2 weeks, it'll be history. It'll be, we'll go off on somebody else's remark. Republican or Democrat, that they'll jump on. She's not affiliated with the party. And I don't think she's ever been affiliated with the party. She might talk to candidates and give them some advice in her expertise, but she is not a consistent Democratic consultant or talking head or whatever.
Bob Hines. Or Alan Moore, go ahead first, then Bob Hines.
All right, let's see, where to begin? First of all, she's not a regular consultant. She has been to the White House 35 times since the administration came into power. That's more than any member of the cabinet other than Geithner, who's next door. Secondly, when Carl says we're not the ones who go to state legislatures telling women what they can and cannot do with their bodies, it seems to me does a disservice to people who believe very passionately in the anti-abortion cause. Now, people can disagree with that. Women are not of the same mind of that, but I just thought that if you're going to talk about these terms, let's be accurate about it, because that's what that fight is about. I also wanted to take issue, while I'm at it, with Al's characterization of what Hillary Rosen was trying to say. She wasn't saying that Ann Romney is not qualified to speak on the economy. She said that in response to Romney saying, I talk to my wife all the time, who meets with women all the time, and she reports to me what women want. Now, that was stupid on Romney's part, no question about that, prompting Hillary Rosen to say, oh, my God, he's listening to his wife? for advice on what women are thinking, and that woman's never worked a day in her life. Now, what she was doing was undercutting Ann Romney as somebody who could represent women's issues. Let's face it. Every politician, and Al can be the first to say this, has to rely on other people and on their own instincts and powers of observation and what they read to learn what the issues are and how people think. God help us if the only way we can learn about women's issues is to have is just from a woman. The only way we can learn about issues that minorities care about is just from minority groups. The only way we can learn about gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered issues is just from those people. That God help us if every time we need to learn about Iraq or Iran or Afghanistan or France or Germany, the only way we can do it is to learn from people who have been there. Because God help us, look at women's issues. Ann Romney is a wealthy, she's a woman, and she turned out to be a wealthy, fortunate woman who raised 5 kids. Okay, does that mean she can't talk at all about experiences of women beyond her own personal experience, or that she can't talk about other issues? I mean, Hillary Rosen's point was she is hardly the best source of information on what women are thinking because of her own background. She's a voice. She's not the only voice. She's not the only source. And so I wanted to make clear that that's what the Rosen comment was. Obviously, she said it horribly, but I think we need to be careful and say, gee, how can he or she as a politician know anything about this issue if the only people he's talking to or she is talking to as a candidate are these 25 people that are already on their staff because no one has just the right grain of information that they need.
Congressman Al,
So the Republicans were wrong in criticizing Jimmy Carter for saying he talked to his daughter about nuclear power. I mean, come on. That was an absurdity, and this one was too. Furthermore, I hope the Republicans continue to keep this alive. They would be smart. They've wrung it out of all of the political advantage they can get, and they should drop it because their position on women's issues is so awful with those who care about it that the less they remind people of the issue, the better off they are.
Well,
their position is so awful on women's issues? Do you want to expand on that a little for us, Al?
Do you want me to extend?
Alan.
One other point that I want to I'd like to make, and that is that before all of us were born, Eleanor Roosevelt had the same problem. People did not like the fact that she was advising her husband. He would send her out on trips. She would come back and advise him and tell him what was going on. She was his eyes and ears. And a lot of people in this country didn't like that at the time.
Well, you know what? It's coming up on 5 minutes to the top of the hour. I think it's time for happy hour, guys. I don't know about you, but this is getting good. Congressman Al, you know, I wanted to finish up, give you the last statement on this one. You know, Alan Moore brings up some pretty solid concepts and pretty solid ideas on this. Is this something that, and not to pick on Hillary Rosen, but she's already picked on Ann Romney. Hillary Rosen is she's a homosexual. She's in a committed relationship and she has adopted children.
Oh, right, that's over, I think.
Oh, but even still, who is she one to judge Ann Romney for? Is it fair for her to make a comment about Ann Romney when she doesn't even have skin in the game, Congressman Al?
Well, of course, she's got skin in the game. That's ridiculous. I think that we are now, because we're out of the Republican primary, we are now going to be dealing on this program and in this nation with more and more things on which we're going to have some fundamental disagreement. And Alan is always cogent and logical and informed. That doesn't mean that we're not going to disagree a number of times now that we're moving into an area where the discussion is going to be about issues on which Republicans and Democrats disagree.
Right. Well, I will tell you this. As a moderator, it's going to be my job to keep everybody kind of in line. Although it makes for great radio, the great thing about our group is, and they even said this in the roll call piece that was in yesterday, the great thing about this group is we're never trying to win the argument. We're never trying to change each other's minds. It is a great discussion. It is great civil debate amongst people who have respect for each other. And that's one of the key things that we're trying to do with this show is it's to show that we can have these disagreements and these arguments and still get together and have a lot of respect for each other and still find compromise in politics. I think everybody... Go ahead.
My greatest ambition is to one day on one issue, however small, to affect Al's opinion.
I have got to tell you right now, I have a better chance of being named Commandant of the Marine Corps than that will happen.
Oh, I will find something small to agree with you on, Alan.
Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. It's happy hour, by the way, now officially. So that means that the folks in Shelley's are going to have their Jack Daniels, their martinis, their wines, and their cigars. I, however, am going to enjoy a nice cherry or strawberry lemonade from Sonic and a cigar out on the porch, and you guys can do whatever you guys are doing at home. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., on Blog Talk Radio, by way of Claremore, Oklahoma, Virginia, and Maryland. Stay with us. We'll be back in 3 minutes. live here in Shelley's Back Room, 13131 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., by way of Claremore, Oklahoma, Virginia, and Maryland. But at least Bob and Al are holding down the fort there at Shelley's. And we invite everybody to take a look at Roll Call this week. Heard on the Hill did a great write-up on our little gang of pundits and our round table here, which was really interesting reading. Now, since before we were going to call a little bit about Mommy Gate and what's going on, but we got a call pop up real quick. Caller from the 804 area code, you're on the air with Backroom Politics.
Hi, I just came across your show. I wasn't sure what you were talking about today.
Oh, well, we can put you back on hold. We'd love to have you listen in. It's a great, great show. Stand up by
me. Well, if I could just interject this much, if it's related to the presidential election.
Absolutely.
The people, they don't like any of the candidates. When are they going to interact with the people and stop being puppets of the elites?
Very good question. Congressman Al, I'll let you start on the Democratic side. What do you think of the question?
When are they going to stop being the puppets of the elites?
Yes.
Well, I don't think they are the puppets of the elites, but I would be interested in how would you do that? If you were president of the United States, how would you go about doing that?
Very simple, Congressman. I'll give you my name so you can look it up on the Internet. It's Hugh, H-U-G-H. The last name is Trawlson, T like Tom, R-A-U-L-S-E-N as in Nancy. Number one, this president ran on transparency. We never got it. We got a backroom deal that put a health care thing that's a monstrosity that's bankrupting this country. Any politician can get the answers for whatever the problem is from the people, put it out to the people, and give them some incentives, and then get the best answers from the people and present them. Then when you go into office, you're doing the will of the people. They'll keep you there, but they're not going to keep you there any 40, 50 years anymore, because they know special interests and lobbyists totally corrupt the atmosphere in Washington. I exposed the former high-level federal government bureaucrat for fraud via front page Wall Street Journal article dated Wednesday, April 27th, 1983, written by staff reporter Jonathan Quitney. Indirectly, it eventually resulted in the eventual resignation of Jim Wright from Speaker of the House in shame. The whole article came about from one short memo.
Sir, you haven't answered my question.
I answered your question. Transparency.
No, you didn't. My question was, how do you go about including the people in, aside from the process we already have of electing representatives? How do you go out and get this feedback the way you suggest it should be?
The people should ask every politician running for office, "What? Don't tell me what you can do for me once you're elected. You tell me today, right here and now, what you can do for the community, for the state, and for the country." The people have the answers. The politicians can interact with the people. The ones with the best answers presented in the best way get elected. And once they're elected, they're under the microscope. If they don't do what they're put in there for, they're right out of there.
Hold on.
My experience was that whenever I went home, that's precisely what went on. We'd have town meetings and that kind of thing, and people would tell me what they thought.
Usually,
they told me both things. They say do X, and somebody else would say do Y, and a third one would say do W. So it sent you back a little schizophrenic, but that's the process that goes on.
Well, you can look at the documents on the Internet when you Google my name. I have letters from my congressmen and senators that thank me for being a wonderful patriot, but they won't interact with me. And I have a letter from President Obama related to the economy, dated July 7, 2009, that I responded to numerous times and followed up with no response. And in my response, I pointed out to the president, I have no risk strategies that can be immediately utilized by businesses are actually strategic intelligent enhancement that will allow businesses at will to expand and diversify to an unlimited degree in any field and create jobs and opportunities at the same
time.
Sir,
I make the suggestion. Okay. I make the suggestion, and I don't do it tongue in cheek, or I don't do it sarcastically. I think you should run for public office. Then you're in a position to implement the kinds of things you're talking about.
I can do more by doing what needs to be done, and that's I'm working on a big mission vision. It's a whole new paradigm. I'm bringing spirituality into global economics and
caller,
combining it with unconditional love.
Caller, where are you calling from, by the way?
Well, that's part of my truth. I'm living now in Ashland, Virginia, which builds itself the center of the universe. I'm self-proclaimed here the heartbeat of America. Ashland sits in Hanover County, where Patrick Henry grew up, who said, "I regret that I have but one life to give to my country." As a Vietnam-era veteran, I feel the same way. All these years later, I'm not going to let it go down the tubes.
Well, caller, we appreciate your call today. Thanks for listening. A lot of comments in that call there. Alan Moore, is in fact our government just in bed with the elitists, or is there some way that we can, discount that kind of statement in America?
Well, part of me wants to say hell no, but let's acknowledge the fact that money matters. Federally elected politicians have to raise money. You have to raise money from people who have money. Now, does that make them elites? I don't know. The fact that you got a very wealthy Democrat and a very wealthy Republican who have very different views, both giving money to the political process. Are they both in beds with the elites? Maybe, but they're a different group of elites with different points of view. And they're not the only point of view, because ultimately, as Al pointed out, you have to win votes. It's not enough to just raise the dough. You have to win the election. And I loved your suggestion, Al. You converted me, that inviting the guy to run for office. Because as you know, and any of us who've worked up there know, there's a cacophony of voices that we're always listening to. They're not all equal, these voices, but they are all important, and every single one can represent a vote.
And Congressman Al, let's go to you on this, because you did run for public office, you were elected, and it's a tough road ahead. When you look at the races now, especially when you look at the presidential race, or you look at even some of the House races in some of the poorer districts, I'll give you a random example. You look at like Oklahoma 2, where the median income is $24,000. Is it money or votes that's going to win you elections?
Well, it's going to be votes, but the question is, what does the money do to influence the votes? And here I would suggest, particularly since the Supreme Court has made its most recent decision, all of the money, in fact, in some races, it will be a minority of the money will have been raised and spent by the candidates. So you've got very wealthy people who are coming in, and their target is not the politician. Their target is the voter. And the voter has got to build sales resistance against that rather than saying that there's somehow the politician is responsible for that.
Well, Bob Hines, I want to go to you. When you hear that kind of cynicism and jadedness, is that just apathy, or is that a result of just misinformation and not being an informed electorate anymore?
Well, there is no shortage of information out there. If the voters want to know what the issues are, it isn't hard to find out, because they are going to be bombarded, both sides, constantly. The information is out there. The real question to me is that it seems to me that the most important thing that voters ought to be doing is trying to understand where people are coming from. And by that I mean, if
understand that, you know, what the parties are, you know, basically saying they want to do, and then listening to members of both parties talking about it in ways that make some sense. And you get an awful lot of information in a campaign. It's available by paid advertisements that try to encourage you, and it's available by any number of informational pieces from magazines, newspapers, what have you, talking ads on programs. It's that you're never short of information. If you want it, you can get it, and you can really inform yourself substantially if you're willing to do a little bit of work and take the time to do it. I just wish more of the population, more of the voters, would spend just a little more time, you know, trying to find out and using the information available, you know, which position they like, rather than complaining about they don't know, you know, what's going on when there's plenty of opportunity out there. I don't want to sound like, you know, a Pollyanna and say everything's great, because it isn't. And there are a lot of ads that are obviously pushed one side and are not giving all the facts. But that's fair enough. As long if you pay attention, we'll be able to find out and understand what is really going on. And so I believe that.
Well, you know, go ahead, Al.
I'm sorry, but people get idealistic about this. There are only about three or four places that candidates can get money to run their campaigns. They can put it in themselves, which means only the rich can run. They can take it from various places, which by definition will be special interests of some sort or another. And make that as transparent as possible, and that's another way to do it. The third way to do it is with public financing. Now, interestingly enough, every poll I've ever seen says the people are really opposed to public financing. The fact is it would cost about 50 cents per person per year to fund both their congressmen and both their own congressmen and both of their senators' campaigns two people for $3 a year. And yet they don't want those greasy politicians to get their hands in my pocket. Well, there you are. Take your pick.
Congressman Al, are you calling yourself a greasy politician?
I am saying I remember talking to a woman on a radio program, and I suggested this, and she says, I don't want those PC politicians to put their hands in my wallet, and that's where that quote came from.
Wow. Okay. We've got that vision to go to sleep with tonight. Thank you, Al. When we come back from our break, we're going to talk a little bit. We're going to change gears here again. The Senate killed the Buffett rule. Is this the last we're going to hear of the Buffett rule, or is this something that's going to keep popping up? And does this mean we're not going to see Warren Buffett's secretary in the gallery during the State of the Union? This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., by way of Claremore, Oklahoma, Virginia, and Maryland. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
Back in 3 minutes.
East of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love. Moon at night. just you and I forever and a day. Love will not die. We'll keep.
Radio. This is Backroom Politics live on from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital by way of Oklahoma, Virginia, and Maryland. You know, as is always the case when you have a live call-in show, we always get some good calls that creates for some good radio. But we're going to get back on track here and talk about the Senate killing the Buffett rule the other day. When we talk about the Buffett rule, we talk about basically as the Obama administration, and I'm going to paraphrase, says, it's the pay-your-own-way type rule. Bob Hines, you want to give us a little bit of a background on what the Buffett rule is and what it means to everybody?
Okay. The Buffett rule is something that a very successful businessman who has who's made a great deal of money, Warren Buffett, and he's made it on his own. He's, you know, on himself. He is a self-made successful individual. He's a very good investor.
Dig it.
And he, some months back, said in effect, you know, it's a shame. You know, my secretary pays taxes at a higher rate, not more money, but at a higher rate, a higher percentage of her income. Than I do. And of course, most 90% of his income is in investments, which are dividends, and which are 15% capital gains, or 15% or ordinary income, you know, is much more. So her percentage is paying, you know, she's paying at a percentage higher than he is, and so it made people, it's an exciting idea. But the truth of the matter is, the Buffett rule, and as Mr. Obama has it, is a 30% charge, in effect, the rate of taxation for anyone over $1 million of income would pay a rate of 30%. Now, that's not, the amount of money that would produce over a 10-year period, according to the budget, the Congressional Budget Office, is a little less than $50 billion. Well, that sounds like an awful lot of money. I think we're borrowing about that much every month or two. In the everyday marketplace of the country, it isn't really a quote a great deal of money, but it does make the point, and the president wants to make it, that we've got to raise some revenues in order to stop these deficit from growing. We are currently today, as a country, borrowing approximately 40 cents out of every dollar that we spend. And we can't keep that up. And that means entitlement issues. That means spending, you know, spending cuts. It means raising revenues, raising taxes. It goes right back to the concept of what I think most people think is a very good proposal by Mr. Erskine Bowles and Mr. Alan Simpson. I'm getting a bit farther away from the Buffett rule that you want. The fundamental Buffett rule would just raise taxes on millionaires, and the money would be significant, $50 billion in 10 years, but it wouldn't begin to cover the problems that we have with our budget, with our deficit. It would be a very small ripple in a very big pond.
Congressman Al, did the Buffett rule vote surprise you, and did it really stand a chance in the Senate?
No, it didn't stand a chance in the Senate, and Bob is absolutely correct. It will not, quote, and unquote, solve our problem. What I think it's addressing is the question of fairness in taxation. We're going to have to raise the taxes of the middle class, along with an enormous number of spending cuts. And the taxes on the wealthiest have been going down and down and down. And they've been placing more of the burden on the middle class. I think the Buffett rule is essentially a propaganda piece, if you will, to demonstrate what the Democrats consider the unfairness of the Bush tax cuts. And also a way of trying to lay the groundwork for a tax increase across the board that will help us, along with spending cuts, help us deal with the deficit.
Alan Moore, I mean, we're hearing a lot of rhetoric going around about the Buffett rule on both sides. What's the reality on this?
The reality is very simple. It's good politics and dishonest policymaking.
That's a pretty bold statement, Alan.
For this administration to focus the time and energy it does on this little minuscule piece of the pie is a great political winner and fundamentally dishonest. As Al said moments ago, and as Bob talked about earlier, the only way that we get this economy back into some closer degree of balance is by a fundamental, widespread reform of inflicting lots and lots of change. I'll say change because some people say pain. Believe me, the pain is coming. Pain is coming with our trillion-dollar deficits, and to fiddle around over here with something that raises less than $5 billion in the name of fundamental change, or even in the name of fairness or equity, I think is really dishonest. And neither party, neither the Democrats nor the Republicans, are being honest in an open and public way about what has to be done. Al just said it. We need taxes on a lot of people. 47% of America pays no tax, no federal income tax. So we can have a debate about who's paying the taxes now, but the point is not enough tax revenue is being generated. The bulk of it today comes from wealthy people. The bulk of it tomorrow will come from wealthy people. And we need more from the wealthy, we need more from everybody, and we need to cut across the board. That was what the whole Bowles-Simpson argument was all about, and we still haven't bitten the bullet. It's probably going to take double-digit inflation and maybe double-digit employment before politicians finally say, uh-oh, I guess we are really going to have to do this, and the public will now understand.
But, I mean, Bob Hines, is this in fact bad policy making in your view as well?
Is what?
Is this in fact bad policy making? Is it?
Well,
is somebody going to just have to fall on their sword and just say, look, we don't like it, we got to raise taxes?
Well, there is, Justin, there is no doubt that we have to raise significant revenue. You can raise it partly by adjusting the tax code, but I believe you're still going to have to raise the rates a little bit. There's no doubt about it. Because we are so far in debt, and we seem to be thinking that it doesn't make any difference, and it does. And we're going to have to adjust a number of our entitlement programs. And I think partly that will be means testing for those who definitely need support, and others who may have paid into programs but maybe are getting more than they might need, and they could cut it back a little bit. I mean, those kinds of problems are very uncomfortable for people to talk about. I mean, the reason that the President of the United States never said one kind word for what Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson have done, and didn't say anything about it at all, just his own commission that he named, is because the answers that they put on the table were so realistic that the President of the United States was not willing to pick up that ball and say, this makes some sense. The fact of the matter is, he should have. He didn't. And if he had, probably Congress wouldn't have wanted him to do it. And that's the thing that we have to understand. The president was a chicken, but the whole Congress is a chicken.
Wow, big words, Colin. Wow.
There is. If you're looking for guts, go somewhere else. You're not going to find it in Washington, D.C.
Well, let me go to Ralph Winnie, let me go to you on this. When we look at the report coming out of the Joint Committee on Taxation, they came up with all the numbers, they crunched them all, and it's basically a Buffett rule saves about $46.7 billion over 10 years,
right?
Basically $4.6 billion a year. Going back to Alan's point, does it make sense for the White House to keep focusing on something that's only going to get you basically pennies on the dollar?
Well, I think they're looking at the polls, and what the polls are saying is that people support an initiative where the wealthiest people in our country pay more in taxes, and the Obama administration is trying to sell that as a way to raise revenue for our country. I don't think it makes good economic sense, but I think from a fairness perspective, the Obama campaign certainly has the upper hand in being able to sell this to the average American who is really struggling in this economy right now.
Alan,
well, the average American has distrusted the wealthy for as long as I can remember, and often unfairly. But I'll tell you what the banking industry did and what have you here recently, and started almost a worldwide recession. Certainly hasn't encouraged the average guy to trust wealthy people. So picking on them is an easy political thing to do.
Yeah, but Alan Moore, is this more of a bully pulpit gone wild, in your opinion?
I don't know about gone wild. It's good politics. And Mitt Romney is the perfect poster child because he gets most of his income from dividends and from capital gains and from hedge fund profits, which is basically what Bain Capital is, and is what Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway, effectively is. These are hedge funds, and they get taxed at a 15% rate, which is stupid. And so for the Obama campaign, he can rail against all rich guys. All rich guys who are paying this low rate of tax, and pick up Romney to boot because his tax returns are out there. So as I said at the beginning, good politics fundamentally dishonest policy.
So where do we, so I go to Bob Hines. Where do we get the reality and where do we get the honesty in all this? Is it just a matter as simple as going back to Erskine Bowles and saying, hey, this is the reality, let's implement it, and everybody's going to be happy or miserable?
You know, obviously, if the Congress would seriously, and whatever administration is here a year from today, would seriously look at Simpson Bowles, they'd probably find a pretty damn good solution. But I don't think they're going to do it. I don't think they're ever going to get there. It's just that the problem is the Democrats are not prepared to go with any changes in the entitlement program. The Republicans say, we're not going to raise revenue. So you have both sides, you know, taking impossible positions, and until somebody is strong enough to, in effect, impose upon them a reality check, we're not going to solve the problem. As I said earlier, we are literally borrowing 40 cents out of every dollar that the government spends. You can't keep doing that. We have a $15 trillion deficit. If we don't do something in another 4.5 years when the next election, is in 2016, it's going to be $20 trillion. And every year that we let it go up another $1.5 trillion or so, just think how much money that is and how big it's going to be, how tough it's going to be to change it the longer we wait. And nobody seems to be willing to say, now's the time to do it. And everybody knows what the answer is. There is nobody on Capitol Hill who doesn't know what has to be done. But there's also nobody on Capitol Hill who's willing to do it. There's nobody in the White House that's willing to lead.
Well, I'll tell you what, I think it's going to be a bigger issue going into the election as we get closer to November and get closer to the general. What I would suggest is we all keep an eye on this, and I'm sure it'll be a subject we bring up here on the show from time to time. We're going to take a quick break here. It's bottom of the hour as we go into our final half hour of Backroom Politics. When we come back, I want to talk about a little bit of the problems that the administration's having, i.e. the issue with Secret Service and prostitutes and GSA and rap videos and trips to Vegas, all sounding like a great time, but highly illegal if you're the government. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back in 3 minutes.
Of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love. We'll keep it.
Talk Radio. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., by way of Claremore, Oklahoma, Virginia, and Maryland. It's a call-in show today. We're going to close out the show with a little talk about some interesting scandals, to say the least, happening over at both GSA and at Secret Service. First, you know, we look at what happened over at the Secret Service, where 11 Secret Service agents assigned to the Presidential Protective Detail were relieved of duty after it was discovered that they had, among other things, Colombian prostitutes in their room. And apparently this all blew up after one of the Secret Service agents refused to pay one of the alleged prostitutes.
And my question is whether or not those prostitutes had a good background check.
You know something? You know something? That is a good question, Congressman.
I didn't intend it to be.
I'm sure some very close examinations did occur. Yeah, I was going to say, Al, I believe they were being vetted as part of the advance team. So, okay, now that we've gone downhill from there, let's talk about something even more cool. So apparently if you're the head of GSA and you want a big morale booster, and what better way to get the morale in your agency boosted by taking everybody to Vegas for a weekend?
Let me count the ways.
Here's the funny thing. When you're the head of GSA and you take your leadership over to Vegas for a morale booster on government money and spend a huge amount of money, it tends to get you to go home and spend more time with the family. Okay, let's call it what it is now. First of all, let's talk about the GSA, because GSA cost the administrator, Martha Johnson, her job about 3 weeks ago.
It should have.
And, well, that's going to be the question is there something substantial to this, or is this just the media feeding the media monster? I want to start with you.
The media will always feed the media monster, and if you're head of a government agency, you should know that, and you should not do anything to embarrass your administration by coming up with something that is obviously not only feeding the monster, but giving them a gourmet dinner. You know, this is inexcusable.
But Alan Moore, I mean, we've seen government agencies go out on boondoggles before. I mean, heck, we could even say that Codells were expensive morale boosters, if you want.
Some Codells.
Congressman Al, let's be honest. The Codells
were unconscionable.
What's that?
And some were unconscionable, and some were extremely useful.
Okay, but Alan Moore, let's look at this. You know, when you look at Codells, I mean, was the GSA story really a story, or was this just something that theoretically shouldn't have wiped out the entire afterguard at GSA?
Well, they spent about close to $3,000 per person for 300 lucky people, well, who thought they were lucky and were until recently, to be able to participate in it. At a time of fiscal restraint and austerity, this was clearly a disastrous problem from the top, and the consequences were heavy. This thing, and Hillary Rosen, and for that matter, the Secret Service, and some military folks were involved too down in Cartagena. This was from a political standpoint a little bit of good luck for Republicans, but it's just sad stuff. I feel no sadness for the people at GSA. That's just stupid. It's just a reminder that a lot of people don't really get it.
Alan, you've just given me the little bit of thing that I can agree with you on.
All right. Well, let me stop.
Well, Congressman Al, let's go to you. What is it that you agree with Alan on?
I think it was unconscionable. Everything he said.
Wow.
It was unconscionable. Yeah. It was done by the head of the agency. It shouldn't have happened. The agency head was being disloyal to the president for allowing this to go on and create this situation. She should have gone, and she is gone, and I hope that whoever takes her place will have learned a lesson from it.
But Bob,
I don't want to leave Cartagena yet. Quite yet either, but we can stick with GSA.
Now, let's stick with GSA. I'll come back to Cartagena, and then there's a Romney dig we can take, too, because we're equal opportunity here on Backroom Politics.
Yeah.
Well, let's finish up with GSA, though. Bob Hines, you know, when you were working closely with government and you've been a part of government for most of your career, when you see something go down like this, it's not unusual for there to be morale boosters, and it's just bad judgment. But should bad judgment take out everybody at the top of an agency like what they did with GSA? Or was this a knee-jerk reaction by the Obama administration?
I don't think you can say this is a problem for the Obama administration. They're stuck with it because it happened on their watch. But these... You know, the people we're talking about at GSA, except for the top dog who's resigned, you know, these regional directors and Mr. Neely or whatever his name was, who was the key instigator of this big party in Las Vegas, these are career people. They were obviously running amok. It was outrageous. And I think, quite frankly, a number of heads have to fall here, and they should. But, you know, I would be less than honest if I said this was all because of the Democrat administration in the White House. That's not the case at all. These were people who were longtime agency and departmental leadership, and they just decided to have one hell of a party. And I just think it's just absolutely outrageous.
But Congressman Al, is this a demonstration of that there is a lack of definitive leadership or a leadership vacuum at the highest levels of government? Is that part of the problem here?
No, I do not think so. I think that to expect the president, who is dealing with North Korea, the Mid East, he's dealing with Congress, he's dealing with all of these things, to be responsible for what an agency, which after all does nothing but take care of federal government buildings, is doing.
So we thought.
He's been focusing on everything else, and he had a right to assume that nobody would be so stupid as to do something like this. Every president that I can remember has got caught by some low-level bureaucrat who lost his mind. And this is Obama's turn in the barrel.
Okay, fair enough. But let's look at Cartagena and what is largely...
Wait, one second. I think basically we need to wait until we have these hearings and people are testifying. If they're going to testify, already people have taken the Fifth Amendment. And we ought to wait until all the facts come out. I've heard there were people that were lied to on this thing, that there even could be kickbacks that were paid. And whether it was this Eastern regional director who orchestrated most of this and told everybody this was fine and we're going to be okay, and he lied through his teeth. Now, and that has shaken up the whole agency. Not that it might not have needed shaking up, but it's unfair, I think, to the people who had to resign. Now, maybe the administrator, she's responsible. She's supposed to know everything. But in some big government agencies, you can't know everything. As happened to government, that you can't know everything. So I think the jury is still out, and I like to wait 2-3 weeks and see what comes down this road and see how bad it is or how or whatever.
Fair enough. So
Carl, you think we should wait a few weeks before we talk about kickbacks, payoffs, and lies?
No, but in this particular instance, you know, there have been some accusations of that in this agency. Now, we know that.
I understand. I'm happy to wait for the facts, too. You were the one who was throwing out these new charges of kickbacks and lies and stuff. I think, yeah, we know some facts. They were substantial enough to force some firings and some people being suspended, and we'll eventually know even more before we're done. You know, I'm of a mind that there was always this sort of sense that Democrats had that Democrats know how to party and Republicans don't. And so I'm wondering, maybe that's a factor here, both in Cartagena and in Las Vegas. What do you think, Al?
Well, wait a minute. I think
that's absolutely true.
That's my Al.
I am taking moderator privilege here, and I'm going to step in on this. I find it incomprehensible that you would make a statement like that, Alan, knowing that the last major corruption scandals that have come out of Congress, it usually involves you're right. It's always Republicans and having their pants down and Democrats having their wallets out. You're right, Alan. I take that back.
They all take turns.
Yeah. I wanted to comment
on Alan's observation that Democrats like to have fun, Republicans have a little bit harder time doing it. I was invited, I don't know why, I was one of about 6 or 8 Democrats invited to a Christmas party of about 450 Republicans. And it was the most amazing thing to me. I mean, at a Democratic party, you can't hear, everybody's talking, nobody pays any attention to anybody. They pay no attention to the entertainment. So I go to this Republican one, and everybody is so well behaved, and I kept thinking, why? And I finally figured it out. It's because every one of them came with 12 marbles in the crack of their ass, and the whole purpose of the evening was that they should walk around all night long and not lose one.
Al, this is a family show, Al. Al, this is a family show. Good Lord.
Well, what's wrong with marbles?
How many marbles, Al? Let me see. I think I got some marbles around here.
You know what? Okay. I don't believe this. Okay, you know what? It's time for my favorite part of the show. This is Tell Me a Story. Not that we can't.
Chicken, you bagged out on the whole thing.
Al.
Shut up. You're telling me to shut up. I will.
Stay with me. This is my favorite part of the show where we talk. You know what? Screw it. Tell me a story. Al, you've already told me a story that I can't go to sleep.
I already told you the story. Yes.
Yeah. Bob, tell me a story.
I don't have a story this week. I'm sorry, I just don't.
Then use one
of Al's. I got the marbles here.
We've lost control up here at Shelly's, I tell you that.
Shelly's nothing. This is what happens when I go to Oklahoma. Oh, please, Alan Moore, tell me you have a story.
All right. So we were talking before about the lack of courage here, okay, in Washington. Well, we've got a new guy who this week has shown maybe an excess of courage because he's apparently written a tell-all book while he's still serving in the Senate. Tom Coburn from Oklahoma.
Hey, Tom Coburn, go Dr. Tom.
It's got a book coming out where he takes the president, Senate Democrats, Senate Republicans, House Democrats, and House Republicans all to task for their fundamental failure to do what we've been talking about, which is to get really, really serious about tackling the federal budget deficit. Tom Coburn served on Simpson Bowles, and he is one of those who voted for it, as did Dick Durbin, the number two Democrat in the Senate, a very liberal senator from Illinois, who also voted for it. And you've heard me say before, if you can get those two guys to put their names on something this big, this grand, this broad, you should be able to get a vote and a majority, and that's the ball the president dropped. But Coburn has decided to name names, and in this book, he's probably burned a bunch of bridges with his colleagues and some people on the outside. Apparently, he really goes after Grover Norquist, the guy who took around the no taxes pledge that a lot of Republicans decided to sign and then didn't know what to do about it, and he basically refers to him as a paper tiger. Anyway, I think that's going to be big news, and really big news inside the halls of Congress, some of which we won't hear about other than through the rumor mill.
All right, that's good story. Ralph Winnie, tell me a story.
Okay. Hillary Clinton is going to run for president. Her whole life has been dedicated to breaking glass ceilings. She's going to look at her competition in the Democratic primary and think she's better qualified than them, and is going to take the plunge and run.
Okay. Carl, tell me a story.
Well, there was an article in the New York Times several weeks ago that talked about corporations and stocks and how certain corporations are trying to make a move to make people who had preferred stock, even if they were dead, be able to vote that stock. And the writer started out the story by telling a story of someone in Chicago who was about to die, and he said, I don't care what cemetery you put me in, but please put me in the cemetery within the confines of the city of Chicago so that I can continue to vote.
It is Chicago. Remember, Mayor Daley once said, vote and vote often.
That's right.
I actually have a couple of stories. Number one, apparently Newt Gingrich doesn't get along with penguins. Newt Gingrich was bitten by a penguin recently at an event down south. And they gave the penguin a shot for tetanus. The other item is, and again, in the arena of, I really can't make this crap up, Politico, because, you know, we love our friends at Politico. Our friends at Politico give us a majority of what we bring up here. But every once in a while, we just see some stuff on our friends at Politico, and we go, really? Well, here's one of them. Our friends at Politico are reporting, because it's everything politics, Kim Kardashian is running for the mayor of Glendale, California. I kid you not, Politico is breaking the news today that Kim Kardashian is running for public office, which if there is any reason why there should be any reason why that in the world there should be campaign finance reform, and if you want any amount of proof that you can buy an election, I just gave you the story. If Kim Kardashian gets elected as mayor of Glendale, I personally am moving to Guatemala. That's my story.
You're already in Oklahoma.
You're already there, man.
Wow. Okay. You know what? We've got 2 minutes. I'm gonna end the show on a nice, smooth Duke Ellington tune. But you know what? Next week we will be back. It will be a call-in show. You know what? Everybody have a great week. I'm out of here. On behalf of Congressman Al Swift, Bob Hines, the Honorable Alan Moore, Dr. Ralph Winnie, and Carl Tuvin, this is Radio's Justin Russell. I'm your moderator of Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio, live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. Bob?
The place to be, and let's all get back here together soon.
We'll be back together soon. Folks, have a great week. We'll see you next weekend. Bye-bye.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Where is it?